Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. We're off on another one of our walks through the Wolverhampton wilderness today. As you can hear all the birds and things around us, it's getting a bit chilly now we're into autumn. And this is episode 8 of our Lao Tzu series. Pete's going to read chapter 13 and then we'll have a chat about it.
Most people fret about themselves and their status, but you don't have to do this. What is success and what is failure? If you have prestige and favour, all you worry about is that it will get taken away. And if you have a lowly place, you are still basically afraid. So both, at the root, make for fear. What does it mean that success is a problem? It means people are too bound up in themselves. If they weren't so self-obsessed, they'd have no heed to be worried. If you can put yourself aside, then you can do things for the whole of the world. And if you love the world like this, then you are ready to serve it.
So looking at the first sentence here, most people fret about themselves and their status. Well, when did Lao Tzu write this? Sort of like 2,500 years ago, something like that. And
yeah.
Then he noticed that people were fretting about the status. Well, I don't know whether things are better or worse. I can't really say. But people seem to fret about their status an awful lot in our society.
They do,
there,
yeah.
There's even a term for it, isn't there?
Yeah, status anxiety is a popular term, a pop psychology, sociology term that you'll come across all over the place. It's part of the general discourse. It's understood. And, of course, we have the famous Facebook status update.
You know, right, yes.
In a relationship,
yes.
You know, and all the rest of it, and
yeah.
as far as I can see, you human beings are chimpanzees, aren't they? Really, and chimps and gorillas and monkeys in general, we're just monkeys, and they tend to organise themselves into hierarchies, dominance hierarchies, and so there's bound to be an issue around status, you know. It's a bit of our primate behaviour, really, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't like to get too socio-biological, but at the same time, I do like us to not forget that we're animals.
Yeah.
You know, socio-biology is a sort of an intellectual direction. It's really stupid in many ways, but at the same time, it just does this one useful thing.
Yeah.
We're animals. We are animals. And most societies, from what I can see, have been organised around divisions of status. In the 20th century, Max Weber ran with this. Max Weber is a very, very great social scientist, and he wanted to nuance Marx. And of course, Marx had just drawn our attention to the division in a particular form of society, the capitalist societies of the newly industrialised countries. And that division was economic class. But Weber said, yeah, that's very good, it explains a lot, but there's other stuff going on as well. And status was one of the demarcations in society that he drew our attention to and analysed. And of course, there's the feminist, of course, of various views, from the suffragists and to the second wave, instituted by Simone de Beauvoir in the 1940s and so on. Look, again, drawing attention to divisions in society along gender lines. But here, Lao Tzu is actually doing his thing of advising us. He likes to advise us. In fact, I imagine that when he was leaving China through the Western Gate to retire from the world into the Tibetan mountains, that in fact the guards wouldn't let him through the gate at first unless he imparted his wisdom to them. And I imagine that what they asked him is, "Oh, great wise one, give us some advice on how to live." You know, and so Lao Tzu is telling us, in order to live the good life, you have to actually drop this anxiety. Because it's not very nice, it doesn't feel good.
No, it doesn't feel good.
Doesn't feel good, you know.
I like Hugh when he says, what is success and what is failure?
You know, it's a model of exposition, actually.
Yeah, it's really
he makes
nice
an observation. He makes an observation about the human condition.
Yeah.
That anybody can agree to. Then he offers a bit of advice about it. He says everybody's anxious about the status, but you don't have to do this. Saying this to these guards at the place, you don't have to do it.
Yeah.
It's a waste of time. You know. And then he asks this primordial question. You know, what is success and what is failure?
Yeah. Because if we're going to take this voyage and just let it dissolve, so it's not really in our minds and we don't really care about it anymore.
Yeah.
Certainly in deep meditation, there's no status in there.
No, of course not.
So you get a good experience of there just being nothing and not worrying about it. But at the same time, it's good to actually think around the question he's done that there.
Yeah.
He's getting you to have a look at, well, what is success and what is failure?
Yeah.
You know, really?
Yeah.
Well, proceeds to give you an answer to the question that he's posed, and he's done it again later on.
Yeah. He's seen status as something that accrues to people from success, and probably in those times that is what happened. You could become famous for being good at something, or for having achieved something, or for having conquered something or somewhere or some people. That would bring some status to you. A successful general would have some status. But also, status, of course, in some societies is hereditary as well.
Well, yeah.
You know, you can still, in this archaic, semi-feudal country that likes to represent itself as the acme of modernity in some ways, you can still actually inherit a title, a dukedom or an earldom. And we have a hereditary head of state. You know, status, or it can be hereditary. Which strikes me as the most preposterous idea ever that's got hardly anything going for it at all. And we do fall prey to mad kings.
Yep.
Just like the Seven Kingdoms.
And the mad queens as well.
And mad queens.
If Cersei's anything to go by, let us be a lesson there.
Yeah. This is a bit like when Mr. Garrison's giving the kids the history lesson
in South Park.
You think he's going to go on about the Pilgrim Fathers and all the rest of it, and he just starts drawing on the blackboard diagrams of the houses of the Seven Kingdoms out of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
As though it was true history, you know.
True history, yeah.
And we kind of find ourselves doing that for some some weird reason.
Actually, you know, the writers of Game of Thrones make an awful lot of very interesting social comments, actually.
They do, yeah.
As well as being a rollicking good story.
Yes. Anyway, that's a slight aside.
We
like to relate things to other things, don't we? So success and failure. I think Lao Tzu is saying, well, again, don't worry about that. They're kind of, who knows at the end of the day, either, as well.
Are there standards just that, you know, in different cultures at different times, success and failure will mean different things anyway.
They mean different things.
If they don't have a set meaning, then they're just...
Yeah, but there's a psychological...
It's an illusion anyway.
There's a psychological point as well. And we've got a saying in modern England. We have a saying, or proverb, you know, nothing fails like success. You know, you might strive to climb up the greasy shit pile and become the managing director of a trillion-dollar company, and then when you get there, you find that it's just one big headache.
Yeah.
You wake up in the morning full of anxiety and overburdened by the responsibility and the stress, and you think, what the fuck? Why did I bother?
Yeah.
You know. And failure, you might be terrified of failing, of having some project that you're working on go wrong. And then it does go wrong, and you actually find, well, actually, I'm still alive. And if I relax, it's actually okay, so what?
Yeah.
Who's going to go through life without occasionally not succeeding in bringing off a project that they're working on.
Yeah, and there's
not every project you work on will succeed. That's just life,
man. It might not succeed in the way you want it to, but it might actually, but you might fail and it goes in a different direction. And you might have, I've found this like quite a lot of times, that the direction it went in was actually far better than one I'd intended anyway.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of fruits that come out of
the
direction that you get deflected into.
Not every time, but there's been quite a lot of times when that's happened.
Yeah, you get deflected into a byway that you might not have even known that it existed.
Yeah.
Let alone anything else. So success and failure is saying don't draw these terms or your understanding of these terms in too much of a black and white fashion.
Yeah.
He's very good at forcing us to be nuanced, Lao Tzu, I think, and to drop in the black and white thinking.
Yeah.
Chang Tzu, Lao Tzu's immediate follower, who was a little bit more humorous and a bit less grumpy than Lao Tzu, does this marvellously. It's one of his whole themes, you know. Don't get trapped in the binarism of good and evil and success and failure and so on. Yeah. And of course, this is right at the root of the yin-yang theories, that the yin contains the seed of the yang and the yang contains the seed of the yin. And everything's in a constant state of dialectical transformation. So what does he say after that? If you have prestige and favour, all you worry about is that it'll get taken away.
Yep.
Well, there you go. So you strive to achieve or gain this good of success, of status, of the status being the respect of the people around you.
Because you think it will satisfy you.
Yeah.
And then when you get there, you find out that there is no satisfaction.
Well, if there is some satisfaction, which there could be, there is a satisfaction in achieving something you've set out to achieve and worked hard to achieve. You have a moment of dopamine.
Yeah.
You know, there's the dopamine hit, which drives people, you know, because it's a significant hit, if I can put it like that.
Yeah.
And actually, if the way of life that you strive so hard to achieve is satisfying, is pleasant, then there's this new anxiety comes in. Well, this could be taken away. It could be taken away by a political change or a conquest, or I might get an illness which makes me unable to sustain what I need to do to keep this thing going, or the people who are involved in this with me in my holding of this position might become treacherous and untrustworthy. So there's immediately an anxiety. There's an immediately anxiety. Study Othello, you know, he gets the girl, but then he's really, really worried that somebody will run off with her to the extent that he imagines that they have when they haven't. It's like the paranoia has become so great that in his mind it's the whole nature of reality changes in the paranoia. And it's true, there is. There is an anxiety that comes with possession of goods. He talked about this later on, about, you know, if you've got great, great wealth, you have to have locks on your door.
Yeah.
If people who live simply in the countryside don't have to lock their doors because they've got nothing to pinch. You know, so, again, this is that dialectical way of understanding where you see that nothing is just simply black and white. That in the attaining of the good, you have the satisfaction of attaining the good, but also then this new fear and anxiety that the good may be taken away. So that's what he's talking about.
He's not saying that the good isn't worth working for. If you want a better world or a better society where there isn't slavery and poverty and all that sort of stuff, it doesn't mean don't work towards goals like that.
Well, no, I mean, later on in this verse, he tells us to do that very thing. But he's telling you that it's never as simple as you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
That there is no end point. That having attained the goal, to imagine that is an end point, is just really unwise. It's just not how it works. Because things keep flowing. And a whole new set of conundrums will arise. A whole new set of challenges will arise. I mean, he goes on to say that, well, even if you have a lowly place, you're still basically afraid. So both, at the root, make for fear. So I suppose that what he means there by a lollipop is you're just a position in life that's just so insecure that you are just in a constant state of fear. And of course that is possible, and there are people that have to live like that. And security is therefore worth pursuing as a social goal. You know, I would say a good society, what does it give to its citizens? Well, it doesn't let them starve. The society is set up in such a way that there are interesting, fulfilling, creative things for people to put their energy into that benefit everybody, that are sustaining and sustainable and nourishing and regenerative where there is degeneration. This is just what any sensible person would want for the society that they live in. Similarly, security. It's a basic thing, security. Societies that can't provide reasonable security for its citizens quickly disintegrates into civil war and all kinds of destructiveness. So he's telling us that not only is there an anxiety that you may lose some high status, some high regard in the eyes of the world, that brings with it certain wealth and power and goods, but at the other end of the spectrum, where you've just got this never-ending insecurity on all fronts, that makes for fear also. He's basically saying, drop fear.
Yeah.
You know, this is a bit of a love or fear speech here, you know. It's like love or fear. And he's associating status with fear, because status can always be lost. One can always be disgraced. You know, because status is about thy consciousness. It is about one's worth in the eyes of the world. But it's also about translating that view of the world into advantages of wealth and power, which of course it does. And in the modern world, this is the whole phenomenon of the celebrity. And yet there's a complete industry given over to the building up of celebrities and the taking down of celebrities for the spectacle, for the schadenfreude and the bread and circuses of somebody who gets famous in the Big Brother house, makes millions of pounds out of advertising products as a famous person, because fame is its own good. And then the gutter press decide to have the spectacle of taking them down, root round in their private affairs. Lo and behold, find out they shagged somebody they shouldn't have done 15 years ago, or some kind of shit like that.
Yeah.
Splashes it all over the front page. Celebrity has nervous breakdown and dies, and that can kind of keep milking it forever.
Yeah.
So, Lao Tzu is very wise in telling us,
yes,
that you don't have to do this.
Yes. Yeah.
And he's putting it down to a kind of narcissism in the very old-fashioned sense. You know, he says, it means people are too bound up in themselves. If they weren't so self-obsessed, they'd have no need to be worried. So he's associating self-obsession with worry. Well, of course, self-obsession is its own kind of worry. And he's talking about narcissism, not in this kind of DSM sense that we hear all the time, you know, Trump's a narcissist and all this, as you know, narcissism as a pathology. Or, I don't know, entirely in like lack of empathy and so forth. They make these things up, actually, even though, you know, there's always a grain of descriptive truth in them. But narcissism in the sense of Narcissus in the Greek myth, who fell in love with his own reflection in the pond. And he was so enraptured by his own reflection, he fell in love with himself, thought he was beautiful. But he starved to death. He didn't even bother to eat, you know, and died. So there's like a bit of a warning against this kind of stuff in the Greek myths also. And then he tells us, well, and he's right, you know, it is an anxious state. Worrying about how you appear in the eyes of the world. Worrying about your status in the eyes of the world. As I said, none of this makes sense without an understanding of their consciousness, of ego being built up out of the reflections that we get back from people. And how that might cause us to manipulate all the social situations we're in to make sure we get the correct reflections, to allay our anxieties and to confirm our status. You can see how this kind of anxiety, this narcissistic status anxiety, produces behaviours. And since it's written so large in society, since you can't have a notion of status without a notion of a kind of hierarchically organised society, you can see that it's also in this syndrome is also influential on our social organisation and our collective manners and customs and so forth. It's huge. It's actually huge. But again, he's saying drop it.
Yeah.
Now, it's very interesting how he goes on. Yes, he says, if you can put yourself aside and you can do things for the whole of the world, and if you love the world like this, then you are ready to serve it. Now, we need to be careful with this because, as you mentioned earlier, it can slide off into asceticism, into the idea that the ego can uproot the ego. Actually, when the ego attempts to uproot the ego through some kind of violence against the self, it actually simply reinforces the ego, or in a sense, reproduces it in a more florid form. You know, spiritual ego, you end up with a spiritual ego, which is more preposterous than a nice ordinary one, a nice modest ordinary one. But it can't be done. The mad mind cannot release the mad mind. The mad mind cannot cure the mad mind. And he's saying, if you can put yourself aside, see, something gentle, one simply lays it down.
Yeah.
And what he's talking about there in that last paragraph is that spontaneous ease that can come upon you when you're gardening or having a meander in the countryside or sitting down, scribbling a few lines in a notebook, or simply resting and watching the clouds. There's a spontaneous ease that can just come to you when you don't in any kind of deliberate way lay down yourself, your ego, your self-obsession, your self-reflection.
You don't put it in a box and force the lid down shut.
No, you don't do anything like that.
Put some weights on top.
It just simply slips away.
Yeah.
You forget it.
Yeah.
And you do literally forget it, not as an act, but as a forgetting. Just like you might forget where you've put your keys, where have I put my house keys, it's like that. You know, forgetting's a funny kind of a thing, because you can't, it's something that happens but that you don't do. And it's rather like that, and I think he's getting at that spontaneous ease.
Yeah.
You know, when one's absorbed in something creative and quiet, then It does just slip away, and it's actually very, very natural. It's not a cultivation. Again, we get back on this thing. It's not a cultivation. It's not an asceticism. It's not a self-torture to make yourself better. It's just the something that will happen if you let yourself be quiet, and if you just step away from the bustle a bit. That's probably the one deliberate thing you need to do. Just step away quietly from the hustle and bustle now and then. Yeah. And you'll find you'll just slip into this spontaneous ease, in which actually there is. If in that moment, sometimes you can have this little spark of self-reflection, and you'll go, oh yeah, where is it?
Yeah.
And it's not there.
No.
You know, you haven't put it away. You haven't tortured it to get it to stop tormenting you. You haven't been to therapy. It just dropped away, and there's a sense that within that quietness you can occasionally glimpse, even though what is this you that glimpses? Okay, big problem. But nevertheless, there is this sense of a knowing that it's just not there, or a noticing that it's just not there. So he's talking about that spontaneity there, I feel. You know, this isn't a cultivation program. It's the spontaneity that he's drawing our attention to.
But when he mentions further up about what is success and failure, there's like, so when sometimes, as you said, when you're just quietly gardening It just drops away, and it is just not there. But sometimes it can leave you in another manner, a more like a positive trauma, as one of we've talked about before, where you can have a blinding realization that can be quite painful.
Yeah.
Where you answer this question to yourself that he's posed here: what is success and what is failure? And you look at the idea of status and you realise it's completely hollow. And like before, in your mind, the idea of status was a golden statue, 100 foot high, top of a mountain of fire, right?
Yeah.
And then you look at it and you realise it's just like
bollocks.
Yes, there's nothing there.
No.
You look again when you have the blinding realization and realize that this golden statue that you thought was so real and so solid actually doesn't exist.
And so worthy of adulation and worship.
Yeah. And that can certainly again, you're not thrusting it aside. It's not cultivation. It can just be.
It's a blinding realization.
Blinding realization that just burns away your ideas about these things.
That's a slightly more spectacular way in which.
But he's giving you the prompt for that to possibly happen by posing that question for you there.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely true, and we talked about this last time. The difference between the Dionysian explosive realisation and then the Lao Tzu quiet dawning. That's so subtle and light and quiet that it's exquisite, but it's very, very quiet. You know, and both of these things are part of the same thing.
Yeah.
Of getting some wisdom, perhaps, might be a way of putting it. But it's interesting, this at the end here, he's saying, well, if you can put yourself aside, if you can just drop the narcissism and the anxiety of the narcissism, suddenly your consciousness and your abilities and any skills that you might have are just this huge open field of play, and that one is suddenly released from a paralysis into an ability to do all kinds of stuff. You know, and he says, then you can really do something for the whole of the world.
Yeah.
And this is his ideal, you know. He's, if you love the world, and one should love the world, it's very lovable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of...
Good old planet Earth.
Good old planet Earth, you know.
Yeah.
I love the world. I said that there are reasons not to, but I do, nevertheless. I love it. I mean, look at this.
Yeah.
Look at this, the old straight track, and the canopy of the trees and the birds doing their thing. It's kind of wonderful. Yes, it says, but it's only then, without that anxiety, without the paralysis of that anxiety, that you can actually do anything for it and for the people, isn't it? And then he uses the word serve here. Well, this translated as, then you're ready to serve here.
And but he's not using the word serve as like trying to suggest that we have a duty to do that.
No. One is motivated by love and not by duty.
Yeah.
And again, duty is an anxiety that might well go with status. You know, what are the big statuses where status really matters? What are the areas of life where status really matters? Well, the military. The whole thing's organised on a hierarchical ranking system. A general has a status higher than a colonel, and a colonel has a status higher than a lance corporal. And a lance corporal has a status higher than a privy. And all of those statuses are enmeshed with certain duties. There's something very doer about duty. There's something very ascetic about duty. And you don't get that feeling in Lao Tzu. There's something very anti-ascetic about Lao Tzu. Which is why he suggests that there are transformations, are these quiet, natural unfoldings, rather than, as we keep mentioning, ascetic self-surgery.
It's a good term.
So what he's got going here in this last bit here is a pointing out of how love can replace duty, and that it's more wholesome than duty. and quieter and more natural than duty, and less wrapped up with the anxieties of status and success and failure. One simply relaxes. When one simply relaxes, what one relaxes is the clench of ego, the clench of status. All of these are kind of tense things. You relax those and love arises. And when love arises, one is able to serve, but not out of duty, but out of the spontaneous action that belongs to love. So this is pretty inspiring, I think.
Yeah.
But supple. It's also quite practical as well. And one of the criticisms that you get when you take these kind of hippie lines of thought is that, oh, well, it's all very well, but it's not practical, it's too idealistic. But Lao Tzu is really, really practical. And you can demonstrate this to yourself quite easily. Just that stepping back away from the bustle, that's the one thing that you do. And then you can let things unfold, and you'll find that that status anxiety just simply melts away. You don't have to have a great drama about getting rid of it.
Oh, well, I hope you found that interesting and had some useful things in there.
And remember to watch Game of Thrones. You know, this is the scripture, the great holy scripture.
And if you want to support us, you know, help us pay the rent and everything, that would be terribly nice.
We're not beggars.
You can become a patron and give us a little bit every month. If you go to the podcast page, there's a green button at the top saying become a patron. So if you click on that, you can follow the instructions from there. So that would be very welcome if any of you would do us the honour of doing that.
Cheaper than beer.
Okay. All right then. Goodbye, folks, and we'll speak to you soon.